Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie.
And I am Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 46 through 50 of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
Yay! We're almost done.
I feel like we always like say that.
Yeah, I've said we're in the end game like every episode, I think. But it is.
I think we kept doing that for Sense and Sensibility too, but we're like, it feels so close.
I know. This book is longer, I think.
It is. Six chapters longer, maybe? Something
yeah, like and that. More stuff like is happening. Like I feel like there's a lot more like, oh, is this the low point? Oh, is this it? And then it's not. Like more stuff happens.
We've talked about it before, but it's definitely like really well paced. So that feeling of like cresting over the roller coaster hill it's just always there, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into that, what are you reading, Jessie?
So I've read a bunch since our last discussion, but I'm only going to talk about two books because I'm gonna keep it together. the first is The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. And it's probably the most buzzy book at the moment. I feel like I've been seeing it everywhere, not only just because its cover is like insanely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just optioned by HBO for a series. And after finishing it, I can definitely understand why. I think it'll make a really good TV show, but it's also a fantastic book. It's about identical twin sisters that grow up together in a small Southern Black community and then run away at the age of 16. And 10 years later, one sister lives with her daughter in the same town, and the other secretly passes for white with her family, and her family doesn't know about her past. And the book follows the sisters as well as their children as their lives sort of intersect in the past and the future. It was really engrossing, and it dealt with sex and gender issues as well as colorism and racism. And I really wasn't able to put it down. And it's going to make a really cool show for HBO. And in the meantime, I highly recommend picking it up. I ended up buying it because I didn't want to wait for like 1,000 years at the library for it. But I definitely think it will entertain you and it'll make you think, and it seems like universally loved, so don't just take my word for it.
And the that's what LeVar Burton would say on Reading Rainbow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, he's like our inspiration, I think.
He really is.
And so the other book I wanted to mention is This Is How You Lose the Time War by Amel Al-Mohtar and Max Gladstone, and it's a quick read. I know that you started it too, Annie. And I think it does take a little bit to get into it and sort of acclimate to the way it's written. But once you get into it, it's just really beautiful. The entire book takes place almost entirely in correspondence between two rival agents who represent their particular faction in a war over a dying world and through time. And at first the letters are taunting, and then gradually they turn into something else and something beautiful. The words are gorgeous and quote-worthy, and I might have to buy it in order to reread it over and over again because the prose is just completely swoon-worthy. And if you love if you love Austen banter, I think you'll love this. One of our friends recently described it as a lesbian enemies to lovers through time, and that's exactly what it is.
I think that's when we were both like, I'm buying this book right now.
Yeah, right now. So I got it from the library, but I might actually buy it. It's super short. It's only like 200 pages or something, mm-hmm. but it's so good.
Yeah, no. So I actually was at work when we both were like, we need this book immediately. And that's a terrible place for me to ever start reading a book in the quiet times at work because there are not a lot of quiet times at my job. So I'm really looking forward to restarting that book and getting into it because it sounds amazing. And what I did get into was, as you said, really beautiful prose and had just lots of fun banter in a very fun, flirty kind of way. It was great. I'm also like in the middle of like a bunch of books because I hate myself
or love yourself.
It's a fine line between the two because these are all great books. I know I'm gonna enjoy myself, but at the same time, like I'm setting myself up for failure, so we'll see what happens. This is just who I am as a person. I've accepted it. Along with This Is How You Lose the Time War, I've also started Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro, which is you know, has a movie adaptation that I love.
Is that with Keira Knightley?
Yeah, Keira Knightley, Carey Mulligan, mm-hmm. Andrew Garfield, Charlotte Rampling. It's a great film. It was written by Alex Garland, who is one of my favorite screenplay writers and now directors. So I actually wanted to sit down with the actual book itself. I'm enjoying that one. Also Lovecraft Country, which you read or finished reading?
Yes, I read it. Yes, I finished it.
Okay. I'm still in the middle of that. Really, really enjoyable. I'm trying to like keep up with the HBO show. But I can't, part of me is like wondering if it's gonna hurt my enjoyment of the show, which is also really, really good so far. It's a lot of fun. I actually really enjoy the differences and what they do with it. Seeing as the book is like written by a white man and it's about a black family and people they know in Jim Crow America facing Lovecraftian creatures, and the showrunners is a black woman, Misha Green, and Jordan Peele's involved, so is J.J. Abrams, not a black man. So the differences are really, really interesting.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed the book so much more than I thought. Like, I went into it with a bunch of skepticism, being mm-hmm. like, there's no way that this is going to be good. It's going to be like super problematic and make me really mad. And it made me very mad, but for other reasons. I think someone told me to read it as an anthology, mm-hmm. and that sort of helped a lot. And I think it, I'm a scaredy cat, so it actually helps me to sort of be aware of some of the scarier things, because it is scary. Like, Lovecraft wrote horror and science fiction. And so that helped me kind of going into it better prepare for more of the overtly scary stuff, as well as the
people are scary stuff.
Yeah, the people are scary stuff. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, but I think that you could easily read it along with the show.
There's a lot of great work happening in tension, and it's not as problematic as I expected it to be. There was a really great podcast called For All Nerds.
Oh, it's so good.
It's really good. They've got a Lovecraft Country podcast to listen along with the show. But a couple years ago, when the book was first optioned for HBO, they interviewed the author, Matt Ruff, and they weren't very shy about being like, so you're white. And he was very open about the fact, like, no, I recognize that this could be a problem, you know, even though I've got like a fairly multicultural background and awareness of people outside my own sort of experience. But I figure if I'm going to do a thing, I've got to do it right. So I think it does actually come through. Recommendation so far. I'm also reading You Had Me at Hola by Alexis Daria, which is so far a fun romance novel about a rising soap opera star who's just had a very public and embarrassing breakup from her rock star boyfriend who cheated on her, and she's about to star in this big not Netflix TV show. And it's fun so far, you know. Instead of like the BFS, she's got her cousins, and she comes from like a, again, multicultural family with like people from Puerto Rico or from Barbados or from the Philippines. And I'm very intrigued of where it's going. And you've got a main character who's trying to navigate, you know, her public humiliation, mm-hmm. and is going to be in this like Spanish speaking show that's probably going to be a big deal, but also because of her family, she's a first or second generation American and doesn't really speak Spanish, much to the consternation of her family, and I super relate to that. Mm-hmm. So far, it's a lot of fun.
I'm on the hold list for at the library, and I can't wait to get it.
I'm enjoying it so far. So much goodness that the books have to offer us. What have we done to be so blessed?
I know. If we have to quarantine, at least we're quarantining with lots of good books.
Yes, thank God we're book people, or else this would have gone very horribly wrong. We probably could just talk about all these books, but
right,
we are here with a purpose.
We're Jane Austen podcast.
She is the godmother of all these books.
Oh, that's so true. That's beautiful. Way to turn it. Way to move us forward.
Keeping us on track here. I'm not sure how that Jane would work into Lovecraft Country, but I'm sure there's something there.
It's a challenge.
Before we get into these chapters, 46 through 50, how about you remind everyone what happened last time?
Yes, well, on our previously on, Dear Lydia goes to Brighton despite Elizabeth's attempts to convince her father to stop her. We also see our friend Mr. Wickham again, but before he leaves, our protagonist is no longer as charmed by him and is not sad to see him go. Happily, Elizabeth goes with her aunt and uncle Gardiner on a tour of Derbyshire, where they stop by Darcy's beautiful Pemberley, where she runs into a much changed Darcy who wants to introduce her to his sister Georgiana. Darcy continues to charm Elizabeth as well as her aunt and uncle, and Elizabeth joins his party, which includes our favorites, Mr. Bingley, who is clearly still into Jane, and his sister, who, despite her attempts to draw Darcy's attentions away from Elizabeth, only hurts herself in the process. So.
Oh, Caroline.
It's kind of more set up for these next chapters, more than anything.
Yeah, but that's how you know something's going to happen.
That's true.
And stuff happened.
Yeah, so would you, Annie wrote this beautiful summary, so I can't wait to see what she came up with.
Please lower expectations.
Okay, I'm sorry, everybody. That includes everybody else.
Okay, so back at the inn in Derbyshire, Elizabeth receives two letters from her sister Jane containing the shocking news that Lydia has run off with Wickham, maybe to get married in Scotland.
Maybe. Gretna Green, which I had to Google.
But also maybe not to get married in Scotland. With a hasty goodbye to Darcy, Elizabeth and the Gardiners return to Longbourn to handle this crisis. Word has it that the young couple might have headed towards London instead with no intention to marry, a scandal that would ruin forever the Bennet's good name and any chance for a decent marriage for the remaining sisters. Mr. Bennet has already left in search of them, and Mr. Gardiner follows soon after. Mrs. Bennet handles it with all the calm composure and grace she is known for. JK, she is in hysterics and is blaming everyone left and right and expecting Mr. Bennet to challenge Wickham in a duel and obviously get killed, leaving the girls at the mercy of the Collinses. Everyone in town quickly learns about what's happened and has an opinion on the matter, including, shockingly, Mr. Collins and Lady Catherine. Elizabeth is pretty sure there is no way Darcy would ever want to be associated with her and her family now. Which is awkward because she's also pretty sure she loves him back and that they would have been amazing together. But hey, some good news, quotation marks. The couple have been discovered and they're not married yet, but they will be if Mr. Bennet agrees to pay Wickham Lydia's inheritance and a very small amount of money annually. There's no way that Wickham would have agreed to this unless he was offered a lot of money on the side by Mr. Gardiner. It's not the ideal solution, but they all know it has to be done, even at cost to Mr. Gardiner and probably Lydia's happiness. Lydia is suddenly Mrs. Bennet's favorite daughter again, and the family persuades Mr. Bennet to allow the Wickhams to visit Longbourn before they are to be stationed in the north, so far from home.
Huh. That was good.
Thank you.
You lived up to my expectations.
Oh, no. Then I'll have to start living up to other expectations, and we can't have that.
No. This is not an expectation-setting podcast.
Okay, we're going to keep it a nice, flat, level playing field here. A lot happened.
And a lot happens that we find out in letters, too. Like, it'd be like letter writing. Something that we talked about in Sense and Sensibility with a lot of letters. Like, now a lot of the action is happening in letters and a lot of waiting around for letters.
Mm-hmm. But not as all-encompassing. Perhaps. Mm-hmm. We have the one from Mr. Collins, which you can talk about later, that it was just there to be funny, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. And to remind sort of the reader of, you know, because he's like happy that she said no in retrospect to his proposal, because then he would be mixed up with all of this nonsense. And so it sort of reminds the reader that Elizabeth too, that Darcy's probably also relieved that he avoided a lot of the nonsense as well.
There's a lot of messy drama happening here, and Darcy doesn't seem like the kind.
That's true, he doesn't.
Can you imagine though, it does drive home how different communication is nowadays? Because I mean, first of all, the United States Postal Office is all over the news nowadays, and they're talking about chapter 46 opens up with Lizzie waiting for a letter from Jane, and then she gets two, right? And the first one, which was sent somewhere else, it went to the wrong place and came back, was just from 5 days prior, and then the second letter was from the day after that first letter was written. How quickly do these things come?
I don't know. And a lot of, they're waiting for their father to, give them news, and he just, sucks at writing letters, so he doesn't send any news, you know?
He just doesn't.
Yeah.
So at least Mr. Bennet just continues to be Mr. Bennet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we'll get to the Bennets. That's why I'm sort of excited to get to sort of the modern adaptions and sort of what they've done with the fact that news travels sort of instantly now, and the difference is, you know, like a lot of times in shows, like a character like breaks their phone accidentally or disposes it somehow, so later they can't be warned about something, you know, like the whole plot of Romeo and Juliet like falls apart if cell phones are involved.
A lot of plots of yesteryear would have fallen apart if we just had texting in them.
Yeah. But so it's kind of cool when you get modern adaptions to see how they use that, like, modern technology into the plot where it didn't exist prior. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's something to keep a lookout for, I guess.
The Lizzie Bennet Diaries does kind of a fun thing with video chat, actually. But we'll get to that.
So Elizabeth gets two letters from her sister, and it's sort of funny that the way that they are read together.
Which is kind of perfect, because what if she just got one letter and then like she had to wait two more days for the other, and being like, okay, so here's how it is now.
In the first letter, we find out that Lydia has run off with Mr. Wickham to get married, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, these are from Jane's point of view, right? So Jane thinks that they're going to get married because Jane is sort of like a simple, sweet, like always looks for the best in people, even when they're awful. So she thinks that the marriage is definitely absolutely going to happen in this first letter.
Yeah. And she also says about Wickham, who she knows a lot about what Wickham has done, is like, but I'm willing to hope for the best and that his character has been misunderstood. You're like, really, Jane? Really?
And something she also says is when she talks about knowing his character, she says to Elizabeth, how thankful am I that we never let them know what has been said against him. We must forget it ourselves. So we have Jane saying specifically, we should forget just how awful Wickham is. Like, we were so smart that we didn't tell anybody. But immediately after both the letters, Elizabeth is like, why didn't we tell anybody? Mm-hmm. Like, we're still, like, I'm such a fool. I highlighted that part because I thought it was interesting that Jane is so, almost to a fault, so good-hearted that she wants to just push it all away.
Yeah. Almost to a fault. Like, to the point where you're like, oh, we need to have an intervention because you're going to get hurt here.
Yeah.
I think it's so funny also that everyone's just like, so they're off to Scotland, so they're definitely getting married. I'm not sure if someone can write in and tell me and confirm for me, is it just easier to get married in Scotland?
So I Googled this. Gretna Green is like in my understanding is that it's like the Las Vegas of Scotland. Like you can get married, like elope there because you don't need to like wait. I think that's what Scotland is. That's the reference. People can tell me if I'm wrong because I probably am. But that's sort of my, because I found an article. It says, why did people originally run away to Gretna Green to get married? And I think it says that it's due to a change in English marriage laws and a happy accident of geography.
Okay.
So Scottish law is different because you can get married in English law. Couples had to reach the age of 21 before they could marry without their parents' consent, and the marriage had to take place in a church. Scottish law was different because you could marry on the spot in a simple marriage by declaration or hand-fasting ceremony only requiring two witnesses and assurances from the couple they were both free to marry.
Okay. Like, I just remembered long time ago the actor Paul Bettany talking about marrying Jennifer Connelly, and they did it in a cottage in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. And I very strongly recall him using the words, they'll marry anyone in Scotland. I don't know if that's disparaging coming from an Englishman, but that is what I'm thinking of now.
Yeah, I like to think of it as the Las Vegas of the United Kingdom. That's like where everybody runs off to get married.
I mean, there are worse places, really.
No, Scotland's, I haven't been there myself, and I'd love to go, but I hear it's beautiful.
It looks nice. It's definitely better than when you get married at the Chapel of Love in Las Vegas, from what I've seen.
I mean, I've never been to either place, so who am I to say?
Sure.
But yeah, so the first letter doesn't tell us a lot. It just tells us that Lydia is gone. And then the second letter is sort of where we really understand the stakes of what's happened, because now it looks like Wickham's not going to marry Lydia, as if any of us actually believed that he was going to.
And this is like very hotly contested throughout so many of these chapters. Is Wickham going to do the right thing? Is he an actual decent person? it doesn't take long for people to start thinking, you know, oh, hey, that guy that we all liked and were completely charmed by, I knew he was crap from the moment we saw him. It turns out he's got all this debt that I was also aware of and just didn't say anything. The gossip mill is fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
In these chapters.
Now, I have a question for you. Something that I never really thought I understood exactly.
Okay.
Why does Wickham run off with Lydia?
I still don't know.
Yeah. Because there's like, she has no money. Like, that's said like a billion times in these chapters. Like, there's nothing, you know, he never seemed like that interested in her previously. She's pretty and young, but like, so are lots of women, rich women. And it ruins his reputation as well, because everyone's like talking about how shitty of a person he is all of a sudden. So I just, it never made sense to me why he would run off with her.
Yeah, because they actually go out of their way, and in one of the chapters, I can't remember which one, to specify that, like, literally no one had any idea that Lydia and Wickham had any interest towards each other. Like, they say, you know, when the militia came to town, Lydia and everyone had an interest in Wickham, but, like, after that, it just kind of faded. And Wickham had never really paid much extra attention to her, and she had the attentions of, like, so many other soldiers. So, I don't know, because there's no real context clues either that he was doing it to spite Lizzie.
Yeah. We know why he ran off. We know why he ran off with Georgiana, right? She has tons of money.
Yeah.
But, and maybe this is me being naive, because they clearly skirt around. It's amazing, like, how many different ways they can say Lydia's no longer pure because, like, she ran away to sleep with this man.
Yeah.
Like, Is it just, like, sex, basically? Is that all Wickham wanted with her? Or he's just, like, a bad dude? Like, I think, like, we just need to take for granted, like, he's a very bad dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess. Because, I mean, if we want to make the sort of correlation to Sense and Sensibility, where you had Willoughby, who just sort of just wanted to ruin some people's lives, maybe occasionally he didn't always just want to marry a woman he didn't find attractive just because she had tons and tons of money.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it's referenced that, but how little of permanent happiness could belong to a couple who were only brought together because of their passions were stronger than their virtue, Lizzie mm-hmm. could easily conjecture. So, I mean, that's the only mention I remember from these chapters, but it is some mention that, like, no, they actually were just really into each other, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's something that I've sort of just taken for granted and never brought myself to think about until we were doing this podcast where we, you know, look a little bit deeper, I guess. Because now he's sort of like outed himself to even his like good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like even Denny sort of sells him under the bus, telling the colonel like, yeah, he's not like the best dude.
Because I don't want to say that there are no attractive or eligible women in Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there aren't, but we don't know that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's an exchange in the beginning of chapter 47 when Elizabeth and the gardeners are on their way to back to Longbourn. And the gardeners are basically like to Lizzie, is he really that bad? Like, we heard he was so good. You know, can you believe that he's capable of this? And Elizabeth says, Wickham will never marry a woman without some money. He cannot afford it. And what claims had Lydia? What attractions had she beyond youth, health, and good humor that could make him forgo every chance of benefiting himself marrying well? So Wickham clearly thinks in this situation that he's not going to marry Lydia, but he's not going to be ruined, but Lydia's going to be ruined. Like, there's a double standard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, on the one hand, at least both our reputations are being ruined.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, clearly, like, this is just a bad idea overall. It's worse for Lydia, but it's just sort of always sort of, it's confusing why Wickham would have done this in the first place, but I think he's just a bad guy.
I mean... One can presume with someone with such extensive gambling debt that he keeps leaving behind in his wake that maybe he is a slightly impulsive individual who doesn't
mm-hmm.
have a lot of forethought about the future, despite the fact that occasionally he's scheming to be like, who am I going to marry for money?
Yeah, that's a good point. That he's very impulsive and doesn't think things through. I think those are things that we've learned about him in this book that would bear, would make sense why he would do this sort of foolish and impulsive thing. And so what bad luck for Elizabeth that the person that shows up right after she receives this news is Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, who, to his credit, upon seeing like how overwhelmed she is, it's just like, good God, what's the matter? I will get out of your way, or I will send someone to do the thing that you need, because clearly you're not in a position where you can go do whatever you need to do. And then he's so amazing, because he's just there for her, being like supportive, sometimes quiet, sometimes offering something to help. Let me call your maid. Is there nothing you could take to give you present relief? A glass of wine. Shall I get you one? You are very ill.
Yeah, it's a really interesting scene, and it's told, I think, from Elizabeth's point of view. Like, it's Elizabeth reading his reaction and telling us, the reader, how we should view what's happening. Versus other times in the book where we're not in Elizabeth's mind, we hear from her parents or her father or even Darcy or her aunt and uncle. Like, this scene is exclusively through Elizabeth's point of view. And she says, Darcy made no answer. He seemed scarcely to hear her and was walking up and down the room in earnest meditation, his brow contracted, his air gloomy. Elizabeth soon observed and instantly understood it. Her power was sinking. Everything must sink under such a proof of family weakness, such an assurance of deepest disgrace. So this is Elizabeth watching Darcy react to her news. And she's telling the reader that she understood what's going on. He's judging her and sort of relieved, because this is like another example of how her family sucks, and he had said that her family sucks, and you know, this is just, her power is sinking.
I love that line, by the way.
Yeah, but like, as a reader, I don't necessarily read it the same way. Like, he seems genuinely upset about what happened, because he also could have prevented it if he had shared this personal information.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, relating to the whole pride thing about all of this. She is very good at presenting herself as someone so strong, and that gives her a lot of value. It, you know, she's the steady one in her family. That makes her one of the smart ones, one of the good ones in her, among her sisters. But like, all these weaknesses about who she is, and her family is so strongly a part of who she is, that, you know, this is, they are a weakness. And he's seeing them all, and it's so hard to feel strong when like the person you like is just like, I now see you as a human being.
and she says here, and she says it later too, but she says, never had she so honestly felt that she could have loved him, and now when all love must be in vain. So she's upset about what happened, but she's almost more upset about now, like, Darcy and her will never be a thing.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me the way we started off getting so much of Darcy's perspective in the beginning, back when he really liked her and she didn't like him. But somehow we've slowly switched places. We get nothing from Darcy anymore, everything from Elizabeth. And now she's the one who's just like, I love him and he doesn't love me. So I guess, yeah, this is just where we are.
I think it's so important that it's from her perspective, because there's like, when he first sees her, like, crying, he says, you know, good God, what is the matter, cried he, with more feeling than politeness, than recollecting himself. So he comes into the room and sees the woman that he loves. We know he still loves her, right? Clearly very upset. And his first response is to have way more feeling and emotion than we've ever seen from him. Even when he was telling her he loved her, it was very matter of fact. But this is the first time that we've seen him sort of panic, show like a ton of feeling, and then he collects himself. So he doesn't like seeing her upset. When she explains what happened, Darcy was fixed in astonishment. When I consider, she added in yet more agitated voice, that I might have prevented it, I who knew he was, had I but explained some part of it, only some part of what I had learned to my family. Had his character been known, this could not have happened, but it's all too late. So I think this is a really important moment too, because it, number one, shows that she read his letter, that she took a lot of it to heart, and that what she's saying about herself also reflects on him. Like, he could easily be saying these words. He could have prevented it. He knew who he was. Had he explained only some part of it, some part of what he had learned, you know, if his character had been known, this would not have happened. So Elizabeth, I don't think, is being passive aggressive here. I don't think she's saying it to make him feel bad, but this is all stuff that he could have done too.
Oh, I love that.
And I think he's upset about it, but she reads his upset as upset, or as, you know, him washing his hands of her being like, I'm never going to deal with this family. I'm upset that this has happened. It's a very layered scene is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Like, she sees him as judging her, which admittedly he has done in the past. Mm-hmm. But she's so concerned, actually, like, genuinely concerned about what he thinks now. Before, it was just kind of like, who the hell do you think you are to be casting judgments on me? But now she's just like, oh, what his opinion actually matters now. And I see what it is. And it sucks.
Yeah. Well, she saw him go with regret. An example of what Lydia's infamy must produce. So, yeah, I think... she's upset, obviously, about her family, but it's also an upset about her and watching her, the love of her life, like, leave. So they make their way to Longbourn.
But, yeah, she can't worry about that right now. She's got other things on her mind.
So she goes with the gardeners, and, you know, they have this conversation in the carriage where they're like, how could this have happened? And Elizabeth is like, well, I know some stuff, but, you know, I don't know what's going on.
The Gardners being our favorite practical couple, who are like, okay, but this is what we believed before. We need actual testimony against his character, because we thought so well of him, you thought so well of him, but now you're like saying he did this horrible thing. Could he really have? You know him better. He was really cute. And she's just like, yes. Yes, he can.
And we find out that Mr. Bennett has gone to London to look for them. And we all kind of think to ourselves, there's no way Mr. Bennett's going to find anybody.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine him being particularly effective. One thing I did want to point out, though, before we move on, this was such a Jane thing. They're just like, okay, Darcy, we got to cancel our plans. We got to go. But in the letters, Jane is like, shall I own? Like, she's very hesitant to be like, I really want you to come back. Shall I own that I long for your return? I am not so selfish, however, suppressed for it, if convenient.
Oh, I love that.
Jane.
And it's just like, say you want your sister to come back. You don't need to be like...
please don't bother yourself, you know, don't rush. But, like, it would be nice if you were here. It'd be really helpful during this, like, complete and utter horrible time in our lives.
In anyone else, it would be passive-aggressive.
Yeah, no, it's just her being like, if you can. Because Jane is so pure and wholesome.
No, I'm glad you pointed that out because I like it a lot. So as Elizabeth gets back and we see how the rest of her family have been handling this, Mrs. Bennett has obviously been handling it very poorly. She's taken ill and is screaming about how Mr. Bennett will get in some sort of duel because, you know, that's definitely something Mr. Bennett would do.
It's like expected of him. Maybe that's why he had such a hard time finding them.
My favorite line about Kitty, who is like very little part in this book. There's this line, Kitty then owned, with a very natural triumph of knowing more than the rest of us, that in Lydia's last letter, she had prepared her for such a step. She had known, it seems, of their being in love with each other many weeks. There's so much here because, first of all, Jane saying that they were in love with each other, like, LOL. And that Kitty like knew that this could happen and didn't say anything because she just wanted to be like, I knew this before everybody else.
These family dynamics are so fascinating.
And then Mary's a jerk. Loss of a virtue in a female is irretrievable. Like, shut up, Mary.
Super, super truths, by the way, that she's dropping. Unhappy as the event must be for Lydia, we may draw from it this useful lesson that loss of virtue in a female is irretrievable. That one false step involves her endless ruin, that her reputation is no less brittle than it is beautiful, and that she cannot be too guarded in her behavior towards the undeserving of the other sex. Which is, she's not wrong, but it being Mary, you know, she's not just lamenting about the patriarchal structures that they're operating in and how unfair it is that, like, if a woman or if a girl runs off with a man, she's forever ruined in the eyes of society. It's more like, Lydia, let this happen.
Yeah. And we also get we find out that Lydia sent this letter, and there's only one thing I even underlined in the letter because it's garbage and everyone knows it's garbage. I just really like the line, what a joke it will be. I can hardly write for laughing. Like, Lydia is so silly, for lack of, I mean, I don't know. It's just such a rude, horrible letter.
It because it all is just a joke to her. She thinks this is hilarious, and she genuinely thinks she's going to be Mrs. Lydia Wickham at the end of this, that there's nothing else that could possibly happen. It's all just romance and passion and elopement, mm-hmm. which is really frustrating. And I feel like a lot of this chapter is just like, I can't believe anyone would marry Lydia. Who would run off with Lydia? No one in their right mind would run off with Lydia.
And yeah, and we also get a sense that like the only person that would run off with Lydia is this moral reprobate Wickham. Like, we find out that Colonel Foster does not speak so well of him as he formerly did. We find out that, you know, he's been in debt with the entire town.
Meryton and Brighton.
Yeah, and that he's just a scumbag, and now everyone's sort of realizing it now that he's gone. And we have the neighbors sort of coming and lording it over Miss Bennet. It is, like, pretty sad to see, you know, how much everyone else is enjoying the misfortune of this family.
Yeah, this is, like, probably the most exciting thing that's happened to everyone in a while. So they all have something to say. They're like, yeah, no, we knew he was terrible.
Everyone declared he was the wickedest young man in the world, and everybody began to find out that they had always distrusted the appearance of goodness. Like, what a line.
Like, you guys, no, you fell for it like everyone else. Even Elizabeth fell for it. And Mrs. Bennet, she's just doing her best at being the absolute worst. She's blaming everyone as well. Even though she was one of the people who was just like, yeah, no, send her off to the militia where all the men are. She's blaming the Forsters for not being there. She mm-hmm. says, I always thought they were very unfit to have care of her, but I was overruled, as I always am, because she wanted everyone to go, I think. Is that what happened? I can't remember now.
But yeah, she wanted everyone to go to Brighton.
Yeah, so she's blaming the fact that they couldn't all be there to keep her in line, basically throwing everyone under the bus and ignoring the fact, like, no, Lydia is just sort of bad at decisions. At some point, was it in this chapter or in the next one, where they get a letter from the Collinses also, who Mr. Collins is trying very, very hard to be really sympathetic and give some sort of solace to the family. But as usual, he's the absolute worst at it.
Oh, this letter is horrible.
It's not great. The death of your daughter would have been a blessing in comparison to this, and it is the more to be lamented because there is reason to suppose, as my dear Charlotte informs me, that this licentiousness of behavior in your daughter has proceeded from a faulty degree of indulgence. It's like, okay, I mean, on the one hand, you're like, I mean, cool for calling him out on the fact that just a lot of this is probably just poor parenting. But why are you talking to, why, hold on, Lady Catherine de Bourgh also agrees that it would be terrible for everyone involved if it happens how it looks like it's going to happen. And then he advises them, let me then advise you. Dear sir, to console yourself as much as possible, to throw off your unworthy child from your affection forever and leave her to reap the fruits of her own heinous offense. Sir, this is not helpful.
Oh, and also, Charlotte, why are you being like that? Why you gotta throw, like Charlotte, what, like, I thought you were on our side, but no, now Charlotte's giving all the tea to Mr. Collins about how Lydia was always like this. You know, Charlotte, you didn't have to say anything.
For real. And also, do not have children with this man, because I do not think he'll be a very affectionate and compassionate father.
Oh, God. You know, I've been reading for this podcast, I've been reading a lot of the, like, spin-off novels and sequels that other writers have written.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think if any of them at all have even mentioned, a child of the Collinses, and I don't think so.
I don't think so. I know somewhere out there there's a spin-off of a, like, correspondent friendship between Mr. Bennet and Mr. Collins, and I'm too afraid to read it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely not. I refuse. I do like, I think in Death to Pemberley, Elizabeth and Darcy have two sons, and then she's pregnant with a daughter, and it's super sweet, even though I hated it.
It has good stuff in it.
Yeah, I like the idea of them having, like, two sons and a daughter. But anyway, in my head, my fan fiction, which I'll never write Pride and Prejudice fan fiction.
Maybe.
I don't want to do research on, like, Regency era stuff. Maybe, like, modern stuff, but...
All right, well, I'll accept
anyway,
that.
Anyway, yeah. But yeah, so this letter is absolutely awful. But I think, like, we kind of touched on this earlier, that it does sort of parallel what Elizabeth thinks that Darcy will think of her. That he'll also be commending himself on the good fortune of not having a connection with this family, that's reputation is being dragged through the mud.
Because you know that Lady Catherine de Bourgh will say something to Darcy, too, because she will say something about anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm. And so is this, I think this is the chapter where Mr. Bennet comes back and has no news and has been pretty worthless, but Mr. Gardner has gone and immediately sends a letter to his wife,
yeah,
like updating her on everything.
They were all very relieved when he's just like, I'll let you know what's going on. And then he's, yeah, like you said, he sends Mr. Bennett home and he's just like, let me handle it. I promise I will handle this. And you go home and be with your family and not duel. Which weirdly, Miss Bennett is super like,
why did you duel?
Why are you here?
It's so funny. She's horrible here.
She's just like, surely he will not leave London before he has found him. Who's to fight Wickham and make him marry her if he comes away? It's like, lady. She just says a lot of things in these chapters where I'm like, I regret a lot of the defense I mounted against you for you earlier in this podcast.
You know, I think that it were right to defend her in a lot of ways because I think our points still have some merit. You know, she needs to get her daughters married.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, wanting her husband to fight and just taking all the attention, like, she also deserves some of our censure here as well.
Yes, just because, like, a lot of her intentions are justifiable and she is a victim of the patriarchy in a certain time period and doesn't have a lot of options in her life and actually just wants her children not to be homeless and starve. Yes, great, but she doesn't necessarily go about it in the healthiest of ways.
I mean, there's something, I think the Gardners are used here really well as a sort of a mirror to the Bennets.
Mm-hmm.
I think both the Bennets here are proven themselves very bad parents. Like the reason, like Lydia is a fanciful girl who thinks that she can do something like this, which I think we can both agree is partly due to, you know, the indulgence she's been allowed by her parents. And the Gardners are a direct, you know, the Gardners are good parents, whereas Mr. Bennett isn't very helpful. Mr. Gardner is helpful. I think the Bennets come across very poorly, but the Gardners step forward and take responsibility. And we're seeing, I think they're meant to be a mirror, like a parallel, the good parents versus the Bennets, bad parents.
Yeah, they're effective for one thing. It's hard to imagine that any of this would have resolved itself in any positive manner if they weren't around. You had, you know, like you said, Mr. Garner went off to take care of everything and like send Mr. Bennett away from where he could potentially cause more trouble for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
At some point when Mrs. Bennett's just like complaining to everyone possible, they're just like, so we agree that we should just limit which servants she's talking to just one, and it's going to be the servant we trust. And so she just reigns at this servant because no one else will be around for her. No one wants to be around to listen to her.
There's a quote that Mr. Bennett gives that I think is really sort of emblematic of his place in the story. He says something like, no, Lizzie, let me once in my life feel how much I have been to blame. I'm not afraid of being overpowered by the impression. It will pass soon enough. So here he finally, you know, says out loud, like, I am to blame here. But then he says, it'll pass. And I honestly think for him, it will pass. He's just like refuses to let himself sort of dwell in the reality of the situation. I think there's a chapter, I think it's chapter 50, where Mr. Bennett, where we all of a sudden get this interlude into the inner workings of Mr. Bennett's brain, where it says, you know, that he'd often wished, instead of spending his entire income, that he laid an annual sum for the better provision of his children and his wife, if she survived him, and he now wishes it more than ever. Had he done his duty, Lydia need not have been indebted to her uncle for whatever honor or credit could now be purchased from her. The satisfaction of prevailing on one of the most worthless young men in Great Britain to be her husband might have rested in its proper place. And so you have this interlude where it talks about how he was frivolous and he didn't care that much because they were always going to have a son, and then they didn't have a son. And it's sort of interesting how the book does this. It like interrupts the forward momentum of the story to have a couple paragraphs where you hear about the Bennett's marriage and you hear about how Mr. Bennett didn't fully deal with anything because they were going to have a son and they just never did. And then he put it in the back of his mind and made a big joke of it.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a lot of credit for being very funny, and there are some very funny lines in here, but it's Mr. and Mrs. Bennett who are at fault, who are the, you know, the reason, I guess.
The source.
Mm-hmm. The source.
They're the source for all of these problems. And I think we talked before, you know, their relationship was also two people who were just like super into each other with absolutely no forethought about what was going to happen afterwards, who ran off and created, were kind of forced to deal with a life together.
Oh my God, are you saying, Annie, that Lydia and Wickham are sort of the same as Mr. and Mrs. Bennet.
I mean, I might be alluding to it.
That's fantastic. This is what the people come here for.
Well, because I think that's why Jane Austen laid it out, you know, last whatever chapters about how their relationship kind of just came together in like the heat of the moment. And then everything was awful and there was no basis to the relationship whatsoever other than the fact that at some point they thought the other person was really hot.
Yes. No, that's brilliant. I love that.
Yeah. And I think that kind of like plays into the fact that we have no real sense of Wickham and Lydia being into each other up until they're in these circumstances where there was not many other options, apparently. So they had each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of interesting. And I like that it happens, even if it probably, no, it's definitely too late to go back on some life choices. But I really like that Mr. Bennet has this epiphany that he has been awful this entire time. Even though he thought he was just like going through life and dealing with the hand that he got. He's like, no, actually, you were setting everyone up for failure.
Mm-hmm. And as much as I do find him annoying in these chapters and sort of useless, I love the exchange. I think it's at the end of chapter 48 mm-hmm. where, you know, Lydia's like, well, or Kitty's like, Lydia always wanted to go to London. She's happy then, her father said dryly. And he goes, I may defer it until Kitty runs away. And Kitty goes, I'm not going to run away, Papa. If I ever should go to Brighton, I would behave much better than Lydia. And he goes, you go to Brighton. I would not trust you so near it as Eastbourne for £50. No, Kitty, I have at least learned to be cautious, and you will feel the effects of it. No officers ever to enter my house, nor even to pass through the village. Balls will be absolutely prohibited until you stand up with one of your sisters. Kitty, who took all these threats in serious light, began to cry. Well, well, said he, do not make yourself unhappy. If you are a good girl for the next 10 years, I will take you to a review at the end of the...
Well, he's trying.
Yeah, I, like, legit laughed out loud.
I mean, I guess it's not too late for people to have growth, even if the ramifications of weird choices are played out in terrible fashion already. He also says at some point to Elizabeth, you know, I bear you no ill will for being justified in your advice to me last May, which considering the event shows greatness of mind. So it's like a nice little bookend to when Elizabeth was just like, oh, it turns out my father is not great at choices and had to deal with that delusionment, you know, dealing with the imperfection of her father. There's something gratifying about him being like, oh, so you were right and you knew better than me.
Yeah, she doesn't say I told you so, but it's there.
It's a very humble moment for him, which is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Bennet doesn't have quite the same moment. I just keep thinking, and I think it was the last episode where I mentioned it, where I was in a conversation with someone who kept like very staunchly defending these choices Mr. Bennet was making, like letting Lydia go to Brighton. And now we're like faced with these chapters where Mr. Bennet himself is like, no, that was bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we as the reader, we know how bad of an idea it is. And now we even know how bad of an idea it is to go with Wickham because, and this was foreshadowed, right? Like we mm-hmm. heard the story of Wickham taking Georgiana. And yeah, Georgiana had lots of money, but Georgiana and Kitty were both like, what, 15, 16? So it was clearly foreshadowed that not only is Wickham a bad dude, not only is Lydia, you know, have flight of fancy, but Wickham has run off with a 15-year-old girl before. Like, he's not above it.
Yeah.
Before we talk about, you know, when Mr. Gardner comes back and explains, you know, what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to talk about why Lydia running away like this is a big deal. And I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? You know, she's, no one ever says it, but or Mary says it, her virtue's gone. It is implied that Lydia went off and slept with Wickham
mm-hmm.
and she's ruined forever. The book, this is one of those times where I'm going to unfairly judge the book by today's standards instead of the Regency era standards.
Okay, I'm listening.
This book is very critical, and Austen is very critical about the difficulties faced by women in Regency society. You know, Austen is clearly passing judgment on the practices of entailment and the necessity of marriage in order to avoid public scorn, right?
Right.
The entailment stuff comes because it's ridiculous that of five daughters, none of them are going to get their father's property. It's going to skip ahead to them to this distant jerk cousin. And Austin is parroting that situation in the book. You know, we also have Charlotte marrying Mr. Collins because it's practical, because she's, you know, people are already talking behind Charlotte's back that she's an old maid at the age of 26 or whatever, because she's not married. And Elizabeth is our voice of reason and common sense. And she's the one that we see question a lot of these things. She's our feminist hero. But Elizabeth doesn't question the idea that Lydia is going to behave in infamy because she ran out with a man. Mm-hmm. You know, Lydia's lost forever is what Elizabeth says. So, I mean, it's not fair necessarily to judge this by our standards, but it is interesting the way that some things are clearly questioned and parodied and then others aren't.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Like when Mary says the thing, you know, talking about virtue and everything, Elizabeth seems really like shocked that she'll even like say it like that. But I think it's probably the most honest and closest to how most people will see how this is. Like this is, she's ruined. It doesn't take very much to ruin a woman. And Lydia has made this choice, you know?
Yeah.
And on top of that, they spend this whole, despite the fact that they fully agree through several chapters that Wickham is terrible and all this stuff, they spend the whole time really disparaging Lydia, who admittedly, very annoying, very dumb, but also a child. Mm-hmm. And they just keep talking about like, we don't understand why Wickham would go off and marry Lydia, of all people. She's very annoying and there's nothing to her. She has no money. Mostly they point out the fact that she has no money. There's no reason to marry her, just over and over again. Because that's just all her value is in what she can bring, how much money she can bring into a marriage.
And I do want to give Elizabeth some credit, because I don't think a lot of her upset comes from the family being ruined. I think it comes from the fact that she's in love with Darcy and this is going to stop them from being together permanently. You know, she even admits, like, she's aware that had she known nothing of Darcy, she could have borne the dread of Lydia's infamy somewhat better. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it's not good for the family about this. But at the same time, the reason it hit so hard is because of Darcy, not necessarily because of Lydia.
The more we talk about it and how society's looking at them, it's just weirdly perverse how everyone is like trying to get in on, you know, and talk about how they knew Wickham was terrible this whole time. Or, you know, Lady Lucas comes by to comfort the family. But actually, even Elizabeth is just like, it's fine if, you know, you want to offer assistance and be helpful. But at the same time, you can, this condolence, this condescending thing that you're doing, she can do that from a distance. We don't actually need that around. It's something really negative and because they're going through something really emotional here. They're like, you know, our little sister could be hurt. She is pretty much destined for a life of unhappiness now. Mm-hmm. And everyone just wants to gawk and point at this messy drama.
Yeah. But then we do get a solution here. Mr. Gardner comes back or sends a letter and basically mm-hmm. says, you know, I've solved it all. I fixed it.
Our practical king.
Yeah. So he writes this letter that basically says, you know, they're not married. There was no intention of them being married, but I fixed it all. And if you'll give like £500 or whatever, like it'll be all done.
And $100 a year.
Yeah. This is instantly looked at as suspicious because they say no man in his senses would marry Lydia on so slight a temptation as £100 a year. Wickham's a fool if he takes her for a farthing less than £10,000. So they think that Mr. Gardner was the one that paid up all this money.
Mm-hmm. And with all his debts and everything, they think it's going to be like 10,000. It's got to be like 10,000, which sounds a lot to me nowadays. But back then.
Yeah. They say like, how is half a sum of like of that to be repaid? Even half of that is just they're never going to be able to repay it. They're never going to be able to repay Mr. Gardner. And they have mm-hmm. their own kids. You know, the Gardners mm-hmm. have all those kids.
It's baffling to them.
And the only person that seems to think it's totally to be expected is Mrs. Bennet.
Oh, God. This is like, these are the parts where I'm just really not into Mrs. Bennet at all. Mm-hmm. She's awful. Because, like, we're back to Lydia being, like, the absolute favorite daughter. Mrs. Bennet is talking with a lot of exclamation points. My dear, dear Lydia, this is delightful indeed. She'll be married. I shall see her again. She will be married at 16. My good, kind brother. I knew he would manage everything. I long to see her and to see dear Wickham, too. But the clothes, the wedding clothes. Lizzie, my dear, run down to your father and ask him how much he will give her. And it's like, oh, Jesus. And when Jane points out, like, all this has happened because her brother was so generous, she says, well, it's all very right. Who should do it but her own uncle? If he had not a family of his own, I and my children must have had all his money. Ugh. Lady.
It's not very good.
First of all, he's got another sister.
And he has his own kids. Like, lady. Mm.
So much entitlement for someone who already has so little.
Yeah. No, it's not great. I mean, I understand her being happy and sort of wanting to overlook a lot of the bad stuff and being mm-hmm. just really so blissfully unaware, or like blissfully refusing to be aware, I guess.
There's like denial, and she takes it to this whole other level because she immediately goes around starts telling everyone that Lydia's gonna get married, but she's telling it to everyone who already knows that Lydia ran off in the first place.
Yeah, everybody knows what happened. Like, it's literally the talk of the town.
And it's kind of interesting how Mr. Gardner like kind of downplays it, because everyone's just like, oh yeah, no, he had to have been paid off like a lot of money, like more money than you can comprehend. And Mr. Gardner says in a letter, you will easily comprehend from these particulars that Mr. Wickham's circumstances are not so hopeless as they are generally believed to be. The world has been deceived in that respect, and I'm happy to say that there will be some little money, even when all his debts are discharged, to settle on my niece in addition to her own fortune. That sounds suspicious.
Yeah, yeah. So clearly there's more there. And we still have, like, what, like 11 chapters left to go? So it's clearly not as clean cut as we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Lydia and Wickham are to be married. And Mrs. Bennet wants to get them a house nearby, Mr. Bennet is like, absolutely not. They're not even welcome here. But of course, Lydia wants to come home and show off her handsome husband to her sisters. So Lydia gets that too. She gets to come to Longbourn.
Yeah. And that's not going to be an awkward dinner table.
No. That I can't wait for that. That'll be good.
Because, like, Mr. Bennett's even, you know, talking about all this stuff about how there's no way Wickham could possibly want to marry Lydia, and basically not trusting him. He's just like, I should be so sorry to think so ill of him in the very beginning of our relationship. But it's like he's accepted that. No, he just hates his son-in-law.
And he's so sarcastic that it's sort of hard to read sometimes.
He really is. I have to wonder about, like, what other characters like him in this time period. Like, I feel like there was always often, like, a kind of, not a clownish character, but, like, someone who brings the wit and the humor. But it's just sort of interesting that as the book has progressed and as everything has gotten for real, he has kind of had to develop into, like, a fuller, richer, more complex character that is dealing with consequences.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
It's kind of fun. And now he's actually making decisions, like not letting the Wickhams come join them at Longbourn. They are not welcome here.
But yet they come anyway. They're going to come anyway.
Oh my God, because Mrs. Bennet's such an enabler. Although Jane and Elizabeth also agreed. They wanted that too.
Yeah. But the most interesting part I found of that, the last chapter that we read for today, is mm-hmm. these musings that Elizabeth has on Darcy. And we talked about how she loves him now, but we get an even more in-depth description about how much she loves him and how much she thinks that they're perfect for each other. And the thing that struck me the most here is this line, the wish of procuring her regard, which she had assured herself of his feelings in Derbyshire, could not in rational expectation survive a blow such as this. So before we were talking about, like, last episode, when we were talking about the previous five chapters, we mentioned how much Darcy had changed and how he was, you know, really actively being nice to the Gardeners and being nice to Elizabeth and introducing her to his sister. And we sort of wondered, you know, we can tell that, and the Gardeners can tell that Darcy's in love with Elizabeth still, but is she aware of it? And I think here she explicitly says, you know, he still loved me there, mm-hmm. which is something that I don't think I ever really realized on previous readings.
That's, oh.
Like, we get no sense that she has some sort of plan to get him to propose to her again.
Yeah. It's just, so I guess what you're saying is just her acknowledging and recognizing the love there, that not yeah. only that he has for her, but also that she realizes she's developed for him.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still there. Like, he was still in love with her, at least when they were visiting him at Pemberley. But now it's all done.
She's like, it's like her resigning to, you know, this is what it is, and it's not going to happen, which is actually very sad Like, a lot of it is just her being like, no, for sure. He definitely loved me, and this is definitely not going to happen. Because, like, he loves his sister so much, and now Wickham is so inextricably connected to her and her family. Mm-hmm. Says she was convinced that she could have been happy with him when it was no longer likely that they should meet. And a lot of this doesn't sound, like, super romantic. It's still very, you know, sensible, very... It's more on the practical side, which sounded weird until I compared it more to everything she was talking about with Wickham. And, you know, Wickham was kind of her first mistake, really.
Yeah.
And this is like her growing because, you know, a lot, she's recognizing that, like, okay, it's not just that he's got a really nice face. It's just that we are really good for each other. Like, I will, you know, warm up that steely exterior his understanding and temper, though, unlike her own, would have answered all her wishes. No, that's not it.
No, yeah, it was a union that must have been to the advantage of both. Her ease and liveliness, his mind might have softened her, his manners improved.
And from his judgment, information, and knowledge of the world, she must have received benefit of greater importance. So it would have been like a match in a really good way, like in a very, on a deeper level where they both become better people for it and recognize each other's faults and find each other really
hot. Yeah, it's a very pragmatic... Yeah. It's soul, they're soulmates, essentially, I like to think. Even though you're right, it is very practical.
Yeah. It's not the swooning, you know, swept away, falling over romance. But as we are seeing in two instances now with the Bennets and now the Wickhams, not great. Mm-hmm. Potentially not great.
It's a very interesting scene where she sort of reflects back on it. And I think it's uncharitable to be like, oh, wow, when she saw how beautiful and expensive his house was, she fell in love with him. But I do think here, this section sort of runs counter to that. It's like, no, she loved his house, obviously, and the grounds. She cares for him, and she sees that they balance each other out.
It's so hard to believe that Lizzie Bennet is the kind of person to come up with a list of reasons why she loves someone.
It's just so sad when she, you know, the irony, you know, like, what a triumph for him. Could he know that the proposals which she had proudly spurned only 4 months ago now would have been gladly and gratefully received? He was as generous, she doubted not, as the most generous of his sex. But while he was mortal, there must be triumph. So she's just sort of saying, you know, he's the perfect man. I love him so much. But there's no way he could possibly, because he's a human, not be turned off by her because of this situation.
It's actually just a really sad chapter in general, because a lot of it is just recognizing how unhappy Lydia is going to be with Wickham. Like, I don't think she really cares about how unhappy Wickham's going to be. No one cares about that. Mm-hmm. But like, even when the news was quickly spreading around and and people were congratulating the family, the good-natured wishes for her well-doing, which had proceeded before from all the spiteful old ladies in Meryton, lost but a little of their spirit in this change of circumstances, because with such a husband, her misery was considered certain. I suspect some of these people probably savored these moments also, you know, just really reveled in the misery, partially because of Mrs. Bennet and the way she went about with the manner she has with being all like, so Lydia's getting married. Mm. Yeah. It's just a lot of people being sad in these chapters.
Yeah, you know, a lot happens and a lot happens to move the plot, but I do think we are ending in sort of like a sad spot.
Yeah. But not without a little hypocrisy from Mrs. Bennet.
Well, yeah, there's humor in there too, but
yeah, she's just very upset that the Wickhams will be stationed in the north, Wickham quitting the militia, which is what Mr. Gardner wanted, but he'll still be with the army and they can like exist peacefully without this scandal hanging over their heads. But of course, the person who really disagrees with that and really wants her daughter nearby is Mrs. Bennet. And suddenly she's a big fan of Mrs. Forrester again. She's just like, oh, we want Lydia to be near her friends again. She's so fond of Mrs. Forrester. And there's several of the young men, too, that she likes very much. It's like,
have you not been paying attention? Yeah. I think we're set up here for the next chapters. We're going to get Lydia and Wickham are going to come to Longbourn. I think that's what we have to look forward to here.
Oh, God. The awkwardness. You've got Bennet, Mr. Bennet, who greatly dislikes Wickham. And isn't the kind to hide his feelings. Mrs. Bennet, who's going to be super happy to see her daughter, who I'm sure is going to be very humble about her circumstances.
Yeah, very. First typical.
Yeah. Elizabeth, who does not like Wickham, but now has to welcome him as a brother-in-law.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be good. We have a comedy of errors waiting for us.
I'm afraid of the secondhand embarrassment that is potentially going to happen.
So before we get into our burn candidates, do you have anything more you want to talk about these chapters?
Honestly, I think I've gotten all I can out of them. There's so much here.
Mm-hmm.
These are a great bunch of chapters, though.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited that we have two more episodes before we get to talk about it as a whole and the adaptions. So lots more to look forward to.
Yeah, there's still a lot of shaking left to do.
Yeah. So you have many more burn candidates than I do.
I don't know if they're like burns, but there were moments that kind of made me laugh and were kind of full of shade.
Oh yeah, there's lots of shade here.
Which you wouldn't have thought in these very serious times, but.
yeah, so do you want me to go first?
Yeah.
I only have two. Okay. So my first one is in chapter 46, and Elizabeth is thinking about Lydia, and she says she never perceived while the regiment was in Hertfordshire that Lydia had any partiality for him, but she was convinced that Lydia had wanted only encouragement to attach herself to anybody.
Yeah, she's not wrong.
And my second candidate is in chapter 47, blaming everybody but the person to whose ill judging indulgence the errors of her daughter must be principally owing. And so that's in reference to Mrs. Bennet, who's blaming everybody but herself about Lydia. So those are my two candidates.
Those were pretty good moments. Yeah, I had I have a few that mostly just moments that made me laugh. Like when the gardeners finally return and hear the news about Lydia, they say, though Lydia had never been a favorite with them, Mr. and Mrs. Gardner could not but be deeply afflicted. It was like, well, we didn't like her that much, but this is still very distressing news.
Yeah, that is funny. I think I skipped over that.
And I think I mentioned this earlier when we were talking about the gardeners being like, we're going to leave the one servant that we trust the most to let Mrs. Bennet complain about this whole thing too. They all left her to fend all her feelings on the housekeeper who attended in the absence of her daughters, because none of them just didn't want to deal with her.
Oh, I love that so much. It's so like subtly shady.
Yeah, it's like no one wants to deal with you, so the paid help will sit there. Oh, so talking about the Lady Lucas coming by.
Ugh.
Of all people, Elizabeth is the one who says this. She had better have stayed at home. Perhaps she meant well, but under such misfortune as this, one cannot see too little of one's neighbors. Assistance is impossible. Condolence is insufferable. Let them triumph over us at a distance and be satisfied. Just calling him out, being like, I know you just want to lord it over us. But it did feel like something that Mrs. Bennet would have said instead of Elizabeth, you know, because in the past she's been the one being all like, the Lucases just want to like be superior to us and see us fail, but Elizabeth was the one to say it. I'm like, girl.
Mm-hmm. Now you can see just how mad she was.
So mad. Like, even if she was accusing them, like, this can't be great.
Mm-hmm.
And this last one, oh, I read this earlier about how the spiteful old ladies in Meryton lost but a little of their spirit in this change of circumstances, because with such a husband, her misery was considered certain. They all want to see Lydia miserable.
Ugh, I get it, but it's a lot.
It's so, like, you could just kind of see him gleefully being like, hey, 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 she's so unhappy. She married the awful man, and now her mom is going around being like, Lydia's going to get married. And you're like, yeah, but to crap.
Ugh. But yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot to look forward to, but those were good. I think we're all winners here.
Yeah, everyone wins, except Lydia.
Except Lydia. Wickham, too.
Yeah, which, I mean, we're fine with him not winning.
Yeah.
And Lydia will be happy at least for a little while.
Yeah, she gets to go to London. She always wanted to go.
She's finally got married. It's literally all she wanted. Now what?
Mrs. Wickham. Oh, God. Okay.
Ugh. All right, we have that delightfulness to look forward to for next episode, when we'll be reading chapters 51 through 55.
Yes, very exciting.
Very exciting. Jesse, where can people find us?
Well, they can find us at our website, thedailynightly.com. They can find us on Twitter at nightlypod and on Instagram at thedailynightly, where Annie posts lots of very funny memes, including my personal favorite, which she posted last episode. And you can email us at thedailynightly@gmail.com and tell us why you want to get married in Scotland.
I am also on another podcast called Still Great Bob. It is a Mad Men rewatch podcast. Please check it out.
Yep, sounds good. Anything else you'd like to add, Annie?
That was enough, don't you think?
Yeah, it was a lot. I think we're going to have some jam-packed episodes coming up.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, it's not going to slow down from here. So until next time, you guys.
Yeah, happy reading.
Happy reading.